What's going on, true crime fans? I'm your host, Heath.
And I'm your other host, Daphne.
And we're from Going West,
a true crime podcast where we discuss various murders, disappearances, and unsolved crimes.
We release new episodes every Monday, and each week we have a different case to dive into.
You can find us over on Instagram at Going West Podcast.
And on Twitter at Going West Pod.
Listen to some of our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also find us over on Patreon, patreon.com/goingwestpodcast, where you can get exclusive, bonus, ad-free episodes every month.
If you're looking for a new true crime binge, check out Going West.
For everybody out there in the world, keep it real and stay weird.
Cheerio.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. In 1948, a prominent socialite named Ruth Thompson Dickens from the Mississippi Delta hacked her mother to death with gardening shears. She calmly called her family doctor's office, but not the police. When questioned, she said that she had walked in on, quote, a Negro man attacking her mother. She said she fought for her life, getting injured herself as he ran out the back and escaped. But there was no evidence that anyone was in that house but Ruth Dickens and her mother, Adela Thompson. Ruth was married to a powerful cotton merchant, well-connected in all areas of society, even friends with the sheriff. Her family was old money and pillars of the community. But she was still brought to trial. 12 jurors did not believe her story, despite seemingly having the support of the entire town, up to and including the governor of the state of Mississippi. The governor would commute her sentence after she served only 6 years. Her story never changed, and her family never stopped supporting her. Ruth's story has faded into obscurity, but it's an interesting story to explore. Racism and sexism both worked for and against Mrs. Dickens after she murdered her mother, allowing her to return to her normal life just 6 years after the murder. Welcome to episode 52, The Socialite and the Gardening Shears, the murder of Adela Thompson. Leland, Mississippi, the hometown of Ruth Thompson Dickens, is located in Washington County in the heart of the Mississippi Delta. The Mississippi Delta, also sometimes called the Yazoo Mississippi Delta, is the northwest section of the state and includes parts of Arkansas and Louisiana. It lies between the Mississippi and Yazoo rivers and is often called the most southern place on earth, though this is a dubious descriptor at best, reflecting the racial, political, and economic problems inherent in the Delta. It's about 200 miles or 320 kilometers long and 87 miles or 140 kilometers wide, and was originally covered in hardwood forest. It's hard to imagine that what we know now as the Delta was once covered entirely by forest, but it was. The region attracted many wealthy speculators after the Civil War, as it became one of the richest cotton-growing areas in the United States due to its incredibly fertile soil. They bought up land along the riverfronts for plantations, naturally dependent on slave labor. But the bottomlands remained undeveloped even after the Civil War. So migrants, black and white, streamed into the area, clearing the land and selling the timber to buy land for themselves. By the end of the 19th century, black farmers made up two-thirds of independent farmers in the Delta. But the white-dominated Mississippi legislature succeeded in disenfranchising African Americans by barring them from voting or even registering to vote. Into the Great Depression, black farmers lost their lands and had to resort to sharecropping and tenant farming. Even after the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s, the African Americans in the Delta never regained their own independent farms. In response, over 400,000 African Americans left the area in the Great Migration during the first half of the 20th century, in which more than 5 million black people left the South. They settled in Chicago, Cleveland, New York, mostly Midwestern and Northern areas, though some did settle in Western cities that were more industrial. As I said, Leland is in the heart of the Delta, located on the banks of Deer Creek. It's decorated every Christmas season with floats and displays, attracting many tourists. But farming is still the basis of the economy, now and in 1949 when our story takes place. Cotton is still king, but soybeans, rice, and corn are also main cash crops. Leland is also in the heart of blues country and is hometown to many famous blues musicians. The music genre originated in the Deep South sometime around the 1870s by African Americans working under the sweltering Mississippi heat. Its roots are in Africa, in work songs also known as field hollers, shouts, chants, and of course spirituals. All rhythmic music, conducive to repetitive manual labor. Leland is just an hour from Clarksdale, Mississippi, home of the Delta Blues Museum and the famed Riverfront Hotel where Bessie Smith died after a car accident on the infamous Highway 61. There are 5 Mississippi Blues trail markers in Leland alone, commemorating the small town's contribution to blues history. And Leland is home to Highway 61 Blues Museum, which features over 80 blues artists from the area and coordinates the Highway 61 Music Festival every year. Today, the strong African-American roots dominate Leland, with the unusual majority of 75% of residents being black. In the 1940s, it was about 50-50. And as you can imagine, the black half of the town pretty much worked for the white half. And that dichotomy reveals much about this case. The one black man who was chosen for Mrs. Dickens' jury pool was struck for cause when he professed that he would never vote for the execution of a white woman, no matter if the evidence proved she did it, even when it was widely known that she was blaming this heinous crime on a black man. I'm going to pause now for a quick commercial break. Ruth Thompson Dickens was born into privilege and old money on June 9, 1906. Her mother, Idella Long Thompson, was the daughter of a doctor, and she married Joseph Wood Thompson in 1898. Joseph Thompson moved to Leland from Charleston, Mississippi in 1891 and is considered a pioneer planter and merchant. He was an alderman, served on several boards and leagues, and was president of the Planters Bank in Leland. After he and Idella married, around 1902, they built the Thompson House, now a historic bed and breakfast, on North Deer Creek Road in Leland. The original house was built in the Queen Anne style of architecture, long and high uniform windows with a large porch with white columns reminiscent of Gone with the Wind's Tara. They renovated the home in 1920, adding several wings, but keeping the interior much the same. The Thompsons loved to entertain and had many events there, including their 2 daughters' weddings. Mildred Elizabeth was born in 1900, and then Ruth Idella in 1906. They were also welcoming of guests. A nephew lived with them for a while, and a couple of other young upstarting gentlemen. One was named John Dickens. John William Dickens was born in LaFleur County, Mississippi in 1901. Presumably, he met his future wife Ruth while staying with the Thompsons. He came from the Mississippi town of money, and evidently came from a little bit of the green kind, too. His father was a doctor, and John was a graduate of Mississippi College, a private Baptist college in Clinton, the second oldest in the U.S. He was a baseball star, team captain and manager. He was also student body president and the head of many other clubs. He was an ambitious young man from the start. He graduated in 1923 and then moved to Leland, where he was staying with the Thompsons for a spell. John went on to be a wealthy cotton planter and merchant himself, owning the John Dickens Cotton Company until his death. And much like his father-in-law, he was a respected alderman, serving on many city and state boards and leagues. He was regarded as a fine, Christian gentleman. And John Dickens actually bought up a lot of property from the Thompson family after Mr. Thompson died to help out with finances. At the tail end of the Great Depression in 1939, Mr. Thompson had shot himself in the Thompson house just 9 years before his wife was murdered. The newspapers are vague and make it sound like it was a possible unsolved murder, but court transcripts show that Ruth Dickens said her father had committed suicide. Ruth Idella Thompson Dickens is described unusually in old newspaper clippings, unless you start to spot the euphemisms. She's called a sportswoman, and especially, once she went to court, there are many veiled comments on her short, mannish hair and plain clothing. The truth is, she liked to hunt and fish. She liked to wear pants. And long hair is a pain in the ass, especially in the hot South when you're a sportswoman. She attended Hollins College in Roanoke, Virginia, and married John almost immediately after her graduation in 1928. Their first daughter, Del Elizabeth, was born in 1935, and Dorothy Jane was born 4 years later. The couple lived on Deer Creek Drive, just 3 doors down from Idella, Ruth's mother, and according to her husband, friends, and family, the two were very close. Idella had sold the historic Thompson House the year after her husband's death, but rebuilt not far down the road. She was 68 years old, and her daughter was 43. Ruth helped her mother out daily, among other household duties. She often collected rents from various farming properties her mother owned. On the afternoon of November 17, 1948, it was a warm day with temperatures in the mid to upper 60s. According to Ruth's official statement, her mother called and asked if she would come over to trim a shrub. She went to her own garage, got the pruning shears, and headed over to her mother's house. She said when she got there, she poured herself a glass of water before taking the shears out to the porch and placing them on a heater. Her mother's cat had just had kittens, and she had also wanted Ruth to go get some paper shavings to make a bed for the mother cat and kittens. She said her mother Idella told her she would meet her at the back door when she got back with the paper shavings, and then she would go with her to the garage to bed down the kittens. So according to Ruth, she got there to perform one chore, and then her mother sent her back to find paper shavings for the cats. It seems more likely she was trying to explain how her own gardening shears would be at the Thompson house when she came back. But she claims she went home and couldn't find any shavings, but she looked in on her 10-year-old daughter, Dorothy Jane, who was sick in bed. She took her temperature and gave her some penicillin. She also said she discussed supper with her cook, Beatrice Smith, and then went back to her mother's house. She said it was well past 2:30 p.m. at this time. Usually, Ruth would park in front of her mother's home when she visited. But this time, she drove into the driveway, headed to the back door where you would go in and unload groceries. She said that when she got to the back door, both the screen door and the entrance door were closed. When she opened the doors, she saw blood on the floor, and then she looked down the hall towards the bathroom and said she saw her mother's feet. She said her immediate thought was that her mother had committed suicide, just as her father had. But she rushed to her anyway, positive she heard her gurgling, and that she was still alive. She claimed that as she stepped into the bathroom, she was blindly attacked by someone standing against the wall to the right of the door. She said it was a Negro man, and he immediately attacked her. She said he was striking at her with those gardening shears, and she fought hard. She claimed as she wrested the shears away from the man, she was injured with 2 wounds on the side of her head and cheek, but she was able to get him to drop the shears onto the bathroom floor. She said at this point, she wasn't sure if the man knocked her down or if she slipped in the blood, but she fell, sprawling on her stomach on the floor. This would certainly account for the blood that was seen on her dress later. She said as she fell, the Negro man had fled out the back door. She got up and ran to the porch, seeing him run off. After this, she said she went to the bathroom to check on her mother, and then went to the adjoining bedroom and called Dr. W.S. Witt's office. She was informed that he was in surgery, but she waited 5 minutes and called back, finally speaking to the doctor, who assured her he would be right there. She said she then sat on the radiator in the bedroom until Dr. Witt arrived. Dr. Witt would later testify that he left immediately after speaking to Mrs. Dickens and arrived at the Thompson home at around 3:15 p.m., Ruth Dickens met him at the front door and then showed him to the bathroom, where he saw Idella Thompson's mutilated body on the floor. The doctor went and called the sheriff before he examined Mrs. Thompson. He noticed that when he went to the phone, he left bloody footprints, and yet Mrs. Dickens had used the same phone and he didn't see any of her prints. At this point, Ruth Dickens was covered in blood and wounds. Her left hand was bruised and already swelling, and her right hand had lacerations. There was a cut on her cheek, but when the sheriff arrived, she agreed to give a statement, but not right then. The sheriff would not get her full statement until a couple of hours after Idella Thompson's funeral a few days later. By then, she had plenty of time to get her story straight. Though she had already told the doctor, the sheriff, and anyone else who came to the Thompson home that fateful afternoon she had been attacked by a Negro man. She might have been able to explain being covered in her mother's blood as trying to help her when she found her, but she also had to explain her extensive injuries. And there was no way to do that except to tell the truth or make up an intruder. A black man came in and attacked my mother, and I fought him off. The sheriff called a man to the scene named Edgar Ballard, who brought a pack of bloodhound dogs used at Parchman Prison. He would later testify that the hounds picked up a scent from the back door of the house, followed it around to the garage, and then turned around back to the house. All searches of the house and backyard found no trail of blood, no footsteps, nothing to indicate that a man who would have been covered in Idella's blood had escaped out the back, as Ruth was claiming. Dr. Witt had gone and examined Idella Thompson, dead on the bathroom floor. The cause of death was more than obvious. Mrs. Thompson had suffered countless cuts and stabs to her face and head. He said the left side of her head was completely mutilated, chopped all to pieces. She also had defensive wounds on her hands and arms. Dr. W.S. Witt, known as Wallace, was actually related to the family, as he was Idella's brother-in-law. And despite being related to Mrs. Dickens as well, his credibility in this case and testimony showed he was steadfast in his belief in stating the facts. He estimated Idella Thompson had been dead for about an hour, something that Mrs. Dickens' defense attorney would later hotly contest in court. Some of the first officers on scene noticed that pools of blood were already coagulating. Dr. Witt examined Mrs. Thompson and found multiple wounds and lacerations to her head. The woman had been wearing a hairnet, and that and most of her hair was hacked away. There was hair with skin still attached on the floor, a gruesome sight, which matched the fracture in her skull just over her right ear. It was about 2 inches long and an inch wide. The doctor said she was struck in the head anywhere from 150 to 200 times. Her right elbow was broken, the middle finger of her right hand was almost completely severed, the ring finger of her right hand was severed, hanging only by its skin. He found lacerations on her left forearm and scratches on her right forearm. He also examined Mrs. Thompson to see if there had been, quote, a criminal assault, which was a euphemism for sexual assault. He found no signs. He would also later let the court know that Idella had been in the hospital for an illness, but had been released that morning at 11 o'clock. Other than the injuries from the attack, she was in the same condition physically that she had been when she left that morning. Idella Thompson was found lying on her back on the bathroom floor, with her head close to the tub and her feet pointed towards the door and the commode. The gardening shears were found lying between Mrs. Thompson's head and the bathroom stool, located in the corner of the bathroom in front of a small cabinet at the end of the tub. Curiously, there was no visible blood on the handle of the shears, though they were found laying in the blood on the floor. The shears were later found to have two hairs stuck between the blades, which were examined and compared to Idella Thompson, along with all the samples found on the floor, the tub, and walls of the bathroom. Some were even on the back porch. While using hair examples today to identify a person is under much more scrutiny as an exact science, back then, they felt it was a positive match. And considering Mrs. Thompson was the victim and the only one missing hair, it's easy to surmise they were right. The back porch was literally covered in blood, just like the bathroom. The doors and walls of the back porch were splattered with blood, indicating a brutal attack and a desperate fight for life. Witnesses would later say that drag marks were evident on the floor between the porch to the bathroom, as if Mrs. Thompson had first been attacked on the porch and then dragged inside. This would also be hotly disputed in court, as the sheriff had the floor cleaned before photographs could be made. When Mrs. Thompson's body was moved, a button was found underneath her arm. It happened to be an exact match to the one torn off of Ruth Dickens' jacket lapel. This is another topic of debate, as when Ruth Dickens returned home that evening, her cook, Beatrice Smith, washed her clothes. Idella Thompson's body was lying partly on a rug on the bathroom floor. A broken fingernail was found on the rug and also on the back porch. 7 days after the murder, Ruth Dickens submitted to a voluntary physical examination with a Dr. Paul Lanier. Her fingernails were all trimmed short and smooth. He found a laceration on the right side of her head, which had practically healed already. There was also a bruise the size of a $0.50 on her forehead close to the hairline. He found a blood clot from a puncture wound under Ruth's left thumb and a laceration on her right thumb. Her left hand was bruised and still swollen even 7 days later, but it was not broken. The cut on her cheek was almost healed. He also found multiple bruises on Ruth's knees, something she never had addressed in her official statement. One could assume she got those bruises from the fight with the black man she claimed attacked her, but she didn't specify these in her statement. Despite the suspicions of many, Ruth Dickens was not arrested right away. She buried her mother, gave her statement to the sheriff, in which she would often slip up and call him by his first name. They were obviously friends. Then she was not forced to be examined by a doctor herself, though she agreed to an examination a week after the murder. For the time being, the sheriff and many people in town were focused on the mystery black man Mrs. Ruth Dickens insisted had murdered her mother and attacked her. But by the beginning of January 1949, the district attorney took the case before a grand jury who indicted Ruth Dickens for the murder of her mother. She pled not guilty and was released on a $10,000 bond signed by her husband. By now, her story about the supposed Negro intruder was losing steam, and it had also become public that she was the executor of her mother's will. I'm going to pause now for a word from today's sponsors. Away is creating first-class luggage at Coach prices. They are using high-quality materials to design a unique and durable product to fit the needs of the modern traveler. Away was founded by two friends who found themselves stuck at JFK Airport with dead cell phones. This is how the Away carry-on was born. There are 9 colors and 4 sizes to choose from. The carry-on, the bigger carry-on, the medium, and the large. Both sizes of the carry-on are able to charge all cell phones, tablets, e-readers, or anything powered by USB cord. All suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate, unrivaled in strength and impact resistance, but also very lightweight, with 4 360-degree spinner wheels that guarantee a smooth walk through the airport. Away offers a 100-day trial. Check it out, and if at any time during the trial you decide it's not for you, you can return it for a full refund, no questions asked. Away also offers a lifetime warranty. You break it, and they will fix it or replace it for life. I ordered the carry-on, and I love it. I glide through airports and I have no trouble lifting it into the overhead compartment, and no more panic attacks over a dead cell phone. For $20 off your first suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/southernfried and then use the promo code southernfried at checkout. Again, for $20 off the coolest and most convenient luggage out there, go to awaytravel.com/southernfried and then enter the promo code southernfried. Lola is a modern approach to feminine care. It is a company founded by women that asks, if we care about the ingredients in our food and beauty products, why shouldn't the same be true for the feminine care products we use? Lola offers a line of organic cotton tampons, pads, liners, and all-natural cleansing wipes. Unlike other major brands, Lola products are 100% natural and come in a simple custom subscription delivered right to your door. Did you know the FDA does not require feminine care products to disclose a list of ingredients on their product boxes? Lola is completely transparent about the ingredients found in their products. Made from 100% organic cotton, Lola's products have no added chemicals, fragrances, synthetics, or dyes. Lola's subscription box is fully customizable, so you can choose your mix of products, mix of absorbency, number of boxes, and frequency of delivery. And Lola is super flexible. You can change, skip, or cancel your subscription at any time. Personally, I love the convenience of home delivery in discreet boxes, and I really appreciate the personalized orders with the right variety for my needs. For 40% off all subscriptions, visit mylola.com and enter the promo code southernfried when you subscribe. Once again, for 40% off all subscriptions, go to mylola.com and enter the promo code southernfried. The trial of Ruth Thompson Dickens was reported on hysterically in the newspapers. It began in late June of 1949, and the Clarion Ledger opened up trial coverage with reporter Bill Keith writing, quote, "In a word, it becomes a stage whereon actors move about. Sometimes the lines are rehearsed, sometimes not. Each side likes to claim the plot has been worked out, but where two plots have been prepared, something's got to give, because the jury only has room for one. He went on to theatrically introduce the players in this courtroom drama. Judge Arthur Jordan, a good-looking Greenwoodian who likes baseball. District Attorney Stanny Sanders, prosecuting the most publicized and controversial case of his career. He pointed out that Sanders had only been in that position a little over a year and a half and described him as an energetic redhead. Defense Attorney Ben Wilkes, known and respected, but also just 1 year younger than the judge, though both look younger than they are, he wrote genially. He said that Mr. Wilkes was dark-headed and dressed more conservatively than his counterpart. And he even introduced the court reporter, Miss Pearl McClellan, who he notes, hears all and says nothing. I could not help but chuckle at all of this introduction in the article. In 2019, we are so immersed in true crime and know so much about the court system, even if it's just from shows like Law & Order. This dramatic explanation of how the courtroom was a stage and the lawyers are but actors is just so antiquated, it's almost charming. But in 1949, trials were theater. Especially the high-profile trial of a prominent white socialite, a planter's daughter married to a powerful cotton man for the murder of her mother. The Times reported that it was standing room only in the courtroom, with people standing on wooden crates in the back so that they could see. First up to testify was Dr. W.S. Witt, the doctor who was first on the scene, brother-in-law of the victim, and uncle to the accused. He spoke candidly about the gruesome state of Idella Thompson's body, pointing out that of the almost 200 vicious wounds on her head, anywhere from 40 to 60% had been inflicted after she was already dead. This would contradict Ruth's statement to police that she had come in and heard her mother gurgling alive on the bathroom floor before she was attacked. Between Dr. Witt's testimony about Idella Thompson's injuries and Dr. Lanier's about Ruth Dickens' injuries, a picture was becoming clear. There had been a violent fight, but it was more likely between the two women, not with the mysterious Negro man Mrs. Dickens was trying to blame it on. Dr. Witt also pointed out that he viewed Mrs. Thompson's body within 7 minutes of Mrs. Dickens' call and insisted she had been dead at least for an hour. As I said before, on cross-examination, Ben Wilkes disputed this estimation. He tried to get the doctor to say that the condition of her body would have been closer to 15 minutes after her death. The doctor agreed that some medical texts would note that the condition of her extremities could be that stiff and cold within 15 minutes, but it was his personal experience that made him believe that it had been at least an hour. The supposition here is that Ruth Dickens had waited to call the doctor, and the reason she would do that is to give her more time to clean up. The gardening shears were found with no blood on the handle, but there was a lady's handkerchief found in the bathtub, inches away, soaked in blood and water. In fact, the sink and bathtub had a great deal of blood in them, not just from the splatter from the attack. Though Mrs. Dickens' clothes were covered in blood and she had injuries, her hands were not covered in blood, nor were her feet. Her leather shoes were examined well after the crime had occurred, and investigators found it possible that blood had been cleaned from them, but with the brown color of the shoes and with the time that had passed, it was impossible to say for sure. They had the same problem with her clothing that had been immediately washed by her maid. Her lawyer objected to the clothing being entered into evidence because of this, and his objection was sustained. That might have been a win for the defense in theory, but there were plenty of witnesses who had seen Ruth covered in blood that day. The point is, they are saying that after Ruth hacked her mother to death, she stepped into that bathtub and cleaned off her prints from the garden shears. And then she cleaned her shoes, avoiding stepping in blood, when she did finally go call the doctor. And why did she call the doctor but not the police? Mrs. Mason, the receptionist at the clinic, said that she sounded calm and did not say her mother was dead, just that she needed the doctor to come right away. Mrs. Mason said she did not mention being attacked by a black man or being injured herself. As Mrs. Thompson had been discharged from the hospital that morning, presumably this was related to her illness, and when she couldn't get Dr. Witt on the phone the first try, she waited 5 minutes and called back. So Ruth coolly called the doctor and then sat and waited for him to arrive. It was the doctor who called the sheriff. Next up to testify was Sheriff Hugh Foote. The district attorney questioned him thoroughly about his actions that day and during his testimony introduced the jury to the murder weapon, the infamous gardening shears. He and Greenville Chief of Police, C.A. Hollingsworth, took the jury through all of the physical evidence, or lack thereof. They had thoroughly searched the back steps, the yard, the entrance, the fences, and every possible way of departure from the Thompson home for bloody tracks or discarded clothing or any evidence that someone had escaped out the back door, as Mrs. Dickens insisted. They found nothing. All blood and tracks were inside the home. And no outside evidence was found inside the home either, except the button that matched Ruth's jacket, and of course her fingernails and the rug her mother was dragged on. I said in the beginning of the episode that racism worked both for and against Mrs. Dickens' case. One point made during trial and also mentioned in her appeal is that, quote, a fleeing Negro would not be likely to have stopped to wash the blood from his shoes before fleeing, and that if bloody, as in reason the Negro would have been, he could not have escaped without leaving behind him a track or a trace, or that being seen by someone in the town of Leland. Basically, they are saying a black man would not have been smart enough to try to hide the evidence, but that a white woman would. It's a gross, racist statement, and yet it was effective in showing that Mrs. Dickens herself would have been that smart. Chief Hollingsworth explained that they had searched in the Negro section of town, questioning many men. Roadblocks were put up for more than a week, stopping every car driven by or carrying black residents out of town. They found no one suspicious. The DA was also able to point out through this testimony that no white woman would have been able to get the shears away from a Negro man, and even if she did, Mrs. Dickens claimed she had fallen prostrate on the floor as the black man ran away. Why wouldn't he have murdered her too? Why wouldn't he eliminate both witnesses? Again, that's a bit racist, but you remove the word Negro, and it's not uncommon to what we might hear in court today. There's no way a woman could have wrested those shears away from a large man, and even if she could have, he still could have killed her. And now the district attorney moved on to the rug Idella Thompson's body had been found on. The rug had actually belonged on the porch, not in the bathroom. This was confirmed by several friends and family. And Chief Hollingsworth from Greenville was the one that found the fingernail on the rug, coming up with a theory of the crime. They thought that Ruth Dickens had met her mother on the back porch as promised earlier in the day, but somehow, a fight broke out. There is no proof as to who struck who first, who was holding the garden shears, but quite obviously, Ruth bested her mother in strength. With the amount of blood splattered and pooled on the porch, it's possible Idella died right there before Ruth dragged her body to the bathroom. And once she got to the bathroom, she continued to strike her mother, hacking her close to 200 times. This was rage. This was personal. Another interesting but racist point was made during Mrs. Dickens' appeal was that a black man or any man would not have inflicted those kind of injuries on a woman. We all know that's preposterous, but their point was a man would have the force to kill a woman quickly and then run, whereas a woman might keep beating to be sure the person was dead. This kind of overkill would indicate Idella Thompson knew her killer. The killer had to make sure she was dead. They may not have understood the nuance of a rage killing, but to them, it made more sense that a woman would have committed that type of crime. And by now, District Attorney Sanders had developed a motive for the crime. Evidently, Ruth had been in the habit of taking out loans that her husband knew nothing about. In August, before Idella's murder in November, she had borrowed $750 from a loan company, with interest of over $150. Remember, I told you her husband, John Dickens, had bought the family's plantation to help out with debt. But Mrs. Thompson did still hold some properties that she rented out for a small income for herself. She had rented some land to a man named Hampton Collier for $600 a year, and on the day she was murdered, his annual rent was due. Ruth Dickens had gone out to see him at the Collier Cotton Gin at least three times trying to pick up that rent check. The check was written out to Mrs. Idella Thompson. Ruth had failed to mention this check in her formal statement to the sheriff or to the chief of police from Greenville. She did, however, mention that her mother couldn't pay her hospital bill that day, maybe setting up a reason that she would have that check in her possession. Maybe she thought if they did ask her about it, she could say she planned on getting her mother's endorsement so she could then go pay the hospital bill. The district attorney suggested that Ruth Dickens had been trying to get her mother to endorse that check that day, and that was how the fight started. Mrs. Thompson refusing to endorse the check and hand it over to her daughter. which means this probably wasn't about her own hospital bill, but because her daughter wanted that money. And why? We don't know for sure. But the loan she took out without her husband's knowledge is damning evidence. She didn't work. He paid the bills. And in that day and age, women just didn't take out loans without their husband's knowledge. But I'm sure the loan company had no trouble giving money to Ruth Thompson Dickens, old name and old money. And for the record, what would the black man's motive have been? Nothing was stolen from the house, and the doctor testified that Mrs. Thompson had not been sexually assaulted. On the stand, Sanders asked the sheriff if he had heard Mrs. Dickens mention the check on the day of the murder, and he said he had heard her mention the check, but he never saw it. It was becoming painfully clear that the small-town sheriff was incompetent, unable to see the honorable Mrs. Dickens as a suspect. Maybe it was inexperience rather than his friendship with the defendant, but either way, it was not good police work. But District Attorney Sanders didn't really play hardball with the sheriff. Defense Attorney Ben Wilkes grilled him on cross-examination, though. But not about the check in question. He was more interested in why the sheriff had the floors cleaned. The Clarion Ledger reported that the sheriff squirmed in his seat and said that he ordered the floor cleaned before the pictures were made. Quote, "I had the floor cleaned myself. People were tracking blood all over the house, and I couldn't see what difference it would make." Defense Attorney Ben Wilkes thundered back, "You mean to tell me that you saw something had been dragged across the floor and then let the floor be cleaned before any pictures were made?" I assume he seized on this error to make the point of a contaminated crime scene, though his argument was not that sophisticated for 1949. The sheriff then went on to say that the family had asked for the floor to be cleaned because so many people had trampled through the place. He also said that at the time he was only thinking of looking for the Negro and never attached any significance then to the drag marks. His testimony was contradicted by none other than Mildred Hood, Ruth's sister, who insisted she actually told the sheriff he should not do that because it would destroy evidence of her mother's murder. Mildred's son, Thompson Hood, also testified for his Aunt Ruth. He said that he had visited with her before the murder and they had gone to a nearby drugstore to have some coffee. After their coffee, he said his Aunt Ruth was headed back over to his grandmother's house and he went home. He estimated that it was about a half hour later that he got the call about the murder. He then told of how he went to the house and he and Ruth still went to see about the mother cat and kittens, fixing up the bed in the garage for them while authorities were in the house. He confirmed that Ruth was still in her blood-soaked clothes. The DA made much of this, that his grandmother was lying dead in the house with the doctor, police, and everyone else concerned that he and his aunt went out to see the kitties. But his mother Mildred defended him. She said her mother, quote, "loved those cats better than anything else in the world. Ruth was attending to those cats for mother because of mother's affection for them. She is still taking care of them." She also said, "It nearly killed me to see all those people trampling through there and my mother still lying dead in the bathroom." Mother always hated any kind of publicity. Perhaps she was hinting that Ruth didn't want to be inside while her mother lay dead and the police were crawling over the home. Understandable if she was innocent, I suppose, but even more telling if she was guilty. There were many witnesses called throughout this sensational trial, but none so thrilling as Ruth's husband, Mr. John Dickens, who gave his testimony with a cigar in his hand. He explained about buying the 1,800-acre plantation from his wife's family for $43,000 when members of her family had appealed to him for help on the debt-ridden property. He was happy to help his wife's family. And as to her personal loans, he agreed he didn't know anything about them, but insisted he trusted his wife. She would have asked him for the money eventually. The point was, Mr. Dickens was a wealthy man. A man who bailed out his wife's family after their patriarch had killed himself. A man who didn't mind paying his wife's small debts. So at this, District Attorney Sanders asked if he had offered a reward to find the Negro killer described by his wife. Mr. Dickens said, "Yes, I spoke to several Negro truck drivers and I went to every dive and honky-tonk in Leland." He claimed he offered $1,500. When Sanders asked him if he ever publicized the reward, Dickens shifted in his chair and said, "No, I did not." Sanders said, "Did you tell the sheriff or his officers?" "No," John Dickens said impatiently, and then said, quote, "It's been my experience that it takes a Negro to catch a Negro. There are three ways to catch a Negro. Find them when they're drunk, when they're gambling, or when they're with a woman. All this uproar about rewards in newspapers and such would just scare a Negro away. It was an appallingly racist statement, but it's indicative of why his wife would blame a crime on a black man to begin with. They were products of their generation and region, and they certainly weren't the only white people pointing the finger at African Americans at the time. Ruth never took the stand herself, relying on her original statement to police to stand as record. It was probably the safest bet. She had her husband, friends, and family all testifying to what a good, loving, and dutiful daughter she was. She had what she thought was a plausible explanation of the murder and her own injuries. She was confident that she would not be convicted. Astoundingly, an all-white, all-male jury saw through all of this. Mrs. Ruth Thompson Dickens was found guilty for the murder of her mother. However, they balked during the sentencing phase, leaving the judge to impose the sentence, saying they were at an impasse during deliberations on how to sentence Mrs. Dickens. Judge Arthur Jordan sentenced Ruth to life in prison. And the decision was upheld by the Mississippi Supreme Court on appeal in December of 1949. But Ruth's husband and her prominent friends and family never stopped fighting to get her released. In January 1951, she was actually allowed out of Parchman Prison to go and try to identify the mysterious Negro man she claimed had killed her mother. She went to Whitfield State Mental Hospital and identified a 16-year-old kid named Charlie Ferguson. Ferguson had escaped from the institute where he had been held since 1947 after being declared criminally insane. When he was around 11 years old, he bought a piece of nickel candy from a store owned and operated by a black husband and wife. He became enraged when he thought they had shortchanged him. He had handed the man a nickel, not a dime. But they threw him out of the store after the argument, and he came back later and shot the owner, Charlie Baskin, and then clubbed his wife Mabel to death. When I first read this article, considering this was Mississippi in 1946, I was shocked he wasn't just thrown in prison. Until I caught the line that Mr. Baskin was a Negro shopkeeper. Knowing all of this about Charlie Ferguson, and having a prominent white lady point the finger at him, things could have gone very, very differently. But Charlie had been living with his grandmother and aunt in Macomb, Mississippi, 3 hours away from Leland at the time of Idella's murder. Considering these were black ladies testifying to his whereabouts, it is still a miracle they were believed. It was an extremely dangerous time to be a black man accused of having anything to do with crimes against white women. That is not hyperbole. Emmett Till was lynched in 1955 in the Delta near the town of Money, about an hour outside of Leland, just for speaking to a white woman. It is more a testament to the mountains of evidence against Ruth Dickens that this young black man was cleared despite her positive identification of him. Her new attorney, W.D. Kahn of Jackson, had set up this little field trip, evidently with the help of a reporter from the Delta Democrat Times, who said he had two newsmen report to him that a Negro fugitive had been there during the time Idella was killed. People in all kinds of places were looking hard to find someone to pin this murder on, anyone but Ruth Dickens. Many petitions, with thousands of signatures, were brought to Governor Hugh White, who honestly felt besieged. In 1953, he addressed these concerns and petitions in an open town hall-type meeting where people who were protesting Ruth Dickinson's release were also allowed to come and speak up. The governor said he received many petitions from prominent citizens all over Washington County, not just Leland. Many people there to protest said that the people on those petitions told them in private that they were pressured into signing the petition out of fear of ruining their business relationship with John Dickens. Dr. Witt, Ruth's uncle by marriage, was one of the loudest protesters, saying, quote, "Whether it was a premeditated murder, slaying in a fit of passion, or if she is crazy, this woman ought not to be turned loose on society." Another prominent but determined protester told the governor, quote, "She has been spoiled all her life with money, and when she was refused, she killed her own mother." In response, the governor said, quote, "It's a shame that these cases should be thrown in the governor's lap by people who sign petitions without sincerity. I have been placed in a peculiar position in this case, in that many of the finest people of Washington County, including one of my senators and two of my legislators, have signed for suspension. So it's clear the governor was under great political pressure to release Ruth Dickens, despite her conviction, despite his state Supreme Court upholding that conviction, and despite many prominent citizens, and in fact, eight of the jurors coming before him to beg that she not be released. This was in October of 1953, and in the end, he did not grant her a suspended sentence. He said he saw no reason to overturn the trial jury nor the Supreme Court in this matter. He did say that a 10-year probation ruling might be considered by the next governor's term, as then Mrs. Dickens would have served 7 years. He was actually setting up the idea that she should have been convicted of manslaughter. But I'll come back to that. Later that month, John Wilkins published an open letter in the Clarion Ledger blasting Dr. Witt, a family member, who insisted that Ruth had done it almost immediately. He claimed Dr. Witt had said as much, that his mind was made up when he got there. This was clearly a bitter fight within the family, and he pretty much ignored all other evidence in the case in this open letter. Dickens ended the letter with, "I know my wife is innocent, and when you are right, nothing stops you or scares you." And he probably wasn't scared. He was confident, and he had reason to be. Because for all the governor's posturing, he had approved of many courtesies to Mrs. Dickens while she was in Parchman. She was allowed so-called Christmas furloughs to attend both of her daughter's debutante balls, neither of which occurred in December. She was also given furlough for a surgery, and had actually been home for months before the public found out. This was in May of 1954. Much was made of the delicate health of Ruth Dickens, who lost a considerable amount of weight while in prison. Her personal physician wrote a letter saying that she had extremely low blood pressure and, quote, a volatile heart. Then, in November of 1955, the governor changed his mind. He again listened to impassioned pleas from both sides, but this time he said he had weighed the evidence on his own and had decided, if anything, Mrs. Dickens was guilty of manslaughter, a crime of passion. He even said, quote, "Mrs. Idella Long Thompson, Mrs. Dickens' mother, had the rose shears in her hands when the argument commenced. She apparently struck her daughter with those shears because Mrs. Dickens bore a cheek wound." And so he suspended her sentence indefinitely, and Ruth Dickens walked out of Parchman, a free woman, on December 10th, 1955. Where did he get that argument? From all accounts, Ruth Dickens never changed her story about the Negro man who had attacked her and her mother. If you're going to commute a murder sentence to manslaughter, you would think the defendant would have at least confessed, but there's no record of this. More telling is the rest of his public statement, that after studying the evidence himself, along with the overwhelming ratio of citizens and officials who favored clemency, he felt this was the right decision. Maybe someone whispered that scenario in his ear to give him an out. Mrs. Dickens certainly had a good lawyer and plenty of people on her side, and it's clear the governor buckled under the pressure. Ruth Thompson Dickens lived out her days teaching Sunday school, even heading up the church's nursery, and staying involved and visible within the community. News articles after her release rarely refer to her conviction or the scandal. But most of those articles were about the next generation. In her daughter Dell's wedding announcement, she is listed as mother of the bride and what she wore along with the rest of the wedding party. That was in February of 1956, just 2 months after her mother's release. Dell actually married a man who would become a senator, Vince Scoper Jr., and in an article I found about his life, this sentence stuck out to me. Vince and Dell made a conscious decision to stay and make Laurel their home. Maybe, with his ambitions for public office, they felt it best to stay away from Dell's hometown and the scandal that was still whispered about there. But in the end, the scandal never really affected Dell or her younger sister, Dorothy Jane. Both went on to lead happy, socially prominent, and philanthropic lives. Mildred Hood, Ruth's sister, who had always publicly supported her, died in 1965. Her faithful husband, John Dickens, died in 1977. Ruth Dickens lived to the ripe old age of 89, dying in Delta Regional Medical Center on January 22, 1996. I discussed a lot of issues in this case, mainly the outright racism of Mrs. Dickinson's defense and how the society people and politicians rallied behind it. I am still astonished that the boy she pointed out, Charlie Ferguson, came out of this unscathed. He had already been convicted of a double murder and declared criminally insane. He was an easy target. But thankfully, on this issue, the governor did the right thing. And apparently, this supposed new evidence was not enough for a new appeal. But one thing I didn't really touch on in this episode is why. Why did she do it? By all accounts, she was a loving daughter who cared for her mother on a daily basis. The district attorney thought it could be about money, and maybe that is true. But the explanation could be much simpler and as old as time. The murder of one's parents has been studied since ancient times. Everything from money to psychosexual motives have been explored by scholars for centuries. But this was matricide. She killed her own mother in a most vicious and violent manner. It was rageful. It was personal. This wasn't a cold murder so that she could cash that check or inherit her mother's estate. We cannot know what happened on that porch that day between Idella Thompson and her daughter Ruth Dickens. All we do know is that Ruth Dickens brought over a pair of garden shears, killed her mother in a fit of rage, and then calmly cleaned herself up, called a doctor instead of the police, and then tried to frame a black man. The relationship between a mother and daughter can be fraught with all kinds of tensions. And I, for one, would love to know what really happened on that porch, and if Ruth really brought those shears to trim a bush. Happy Mother's Day. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. This episode was suggested by a listener who asked not to be named, but I really appreciate her trusting me with this story. Almost all of my research came exclusively from newspaper articles of the time, as well as Mrs. Dickens' appeal transcripts. There was also a delightful article by Julia Reed called In Defense of Southern Womanhood, How to Kill Your Man and Walk Away, which appeared in the Oxford American Magazine of the South in spring of 1996. I've mentioned it a couple of times now, but reminder, I'll be back at CrimeCon this year in New Orleans. I really hope some of you can make the trip. I would love to meet you, and I'm so looking forward to seeing the familiar faces from last year. It's June 7th through the 9th, and if you're interested in going, please use my promo code to purchase your ticket. It's FriedCrime19. Several of your favorite podcasters will also be in the Big Easy, along with speakers, exhibits, workshops, and everything CrimeCon has to offer. So again, to buy a ticket, don't forget to use my code FriedCrime19. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm on most large platforms like Stitcher and most podcatchers. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I am also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform. If you're interested in discussing this case or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It's linked to my Southern Fried True Crime Facebook page. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.